Welcome to Juno Afternoon, as we reflect on the 20th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks. I'm Rhonda McBride. Coming up, 20 years ago, many were connected to 9/11 in one way or another, but in Juno, there are some who felt the tragedy's direct impact. Also, an update on the Juno Glacier Valley Rotary Club's 9/11 memorial. Many of you will be surprised to learn that it was one of the first in the nation to be built. Now for our forecast, if you plan to go to the Riverside Rotary Park for tomorrow's memorial ceremony, be sure and dress for the weather. Widespread rain showers for tonight and tomorrow morning, tapering off in the evening, and mostly cloudy skies on Sunday, but still a chance of rain. And for that matter, the wet weather will be with us through midweek. Juno Afternoon will be right back after National Native News. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride, here with you on the eve of the 20th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks on New York City and the Pentagon. Even as far away as Alaska, the shockwave slammed us hard. We knew in an instant that our world had changed forever. Most of you probably remember exactly where you were and exactly what you were doing the very moment you realized our country was under attack. And yet, it's hard to believe 20 years have flown by, and still so many lingering questions. And while we'll probably raise more questions than answers on today's show, we can share some memories and, like pieces of a puzzle, see what picture emerges when we put them together, perhaps to find some hope and inspiration. We have several guests with a direct connection to 9/11, but first, take a little time. Unpack some of your own memories to ready yourself for our conversation as we explore how the events of that day continue to ripple across time. Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. So wonderful to have everyone here today, which I hope will be almost kind of like a hearth where we're gathered around to share some stories about a shared experience that continues to be a thread in our daily lives, whether we know it or not. And we have invited Libby Bacalar, a Juno attorney who lived in New York on the day of the attack, Dorlisa Nazario, who lost an uncle that day, Dr. Destiny Sargent, a psychologist who traveled to New York City to work with a group from Juno to offer help, and Christina Apathy, a well-known theater professor here in Juno. So we thank all of you for taking the time to be here. And I'll start off with Libby Bacalar. If you could each tell us where you were and what you were doing when the attack occurred.
Okay, so I was 23 years old, and I was working for a city agency in Lower Manhattan, four blocks away from the World Trade Center, a couple blocks south. And I was at work at about 8 in the morning, and a coworker came over to me and said that a plane had hit the World Trade Center. And I said to her, oh, like, you know, a tourist plane or something. And she said, no, I think it's a 747. So I said, what? And we went downstairs. We worked on the second floor. We went down to the lobby and out into the street. And we saw the first tower on fire with, you know, a giant hole in the building and flames and papers coming out. And then while we were standing there, the second plane came across the West Side Highway and hit the second building. And it was just like a total explosive sound. And kind of at that moment, everybody knew it was an intentional attack, you know, and that's sort of when the panic kind of set in, I think. I ran upstairs, got all my stuff, all of us just kind of stood there in shock for a while before we were trying to figure out what to do. Where we were on Rector Street, the buildings were to the south of us, to the north of us, a couple of blocks, and then to the south of us was water, to the west of us was water, and to the east was the Brooklyn Bridge, was the only direction to go. And I lived there, and so did a lot of my colleagues. So we started walking to the Brooklyn Bridge, and it was just sort of low-key panic. I think people didn't really know what else was going to happen. We got to the bridge, and we helped a bunch of people over onto the pedestrian walkway. And this was before the first tower fell. And I was walking across the Brooklyn Bridge with a couple of friends. And while we were in the middle of the bridge, the first tower collapsed. And if you've ever been to New York City or stood on the Brooklyn Bridge, you know that the World Trade Center was kind of right there. We all turned around and watched it just come down, and it was surreal. And the bridge was shaking, and it was kind of like an earthquake. And I had sort of this out of body experience moment where I kind of went out of my body, and I definitely thought I was going to die on the bridge, and just had this like peace come over me and this feeling of like everything's going to be okay. And I was kind of looking around for what to hang on to physically if the bridge started to like crumble or something. That obviously didn't end up happening, but at the time it seemed like it was going to. So that was just kind of the most memorable thing about it for me, was that calm that came over me and feeling like my emergency switch had been flipped and I was in this calm, relaxed, just inner peace mode. Feeling like, okay, like this is it, you know? And the bridge stopped shaking. The building came down. I was born and raised in New York City, so it was just kind of like this sick feeling to see this piece of the skyline just collapse onto itself. And no one could believe it. Everyone was just like in complete shock. I walked back to Brooklyn, and my boyfriend that I was living with opened the door, and he was crying, and you know, everybody in my family was wondering where I was, because the way it looked, Lower Manhattan looked, you know, absolutely like the nuclear war had happened there. My parents' next door neighbor in their apartment building in the Bronx, he was a firefighter, one of the first companies to get down there. He died. A coworker of mine died of a heart attack, actually, not from the collapse, but I felt lucky that I got out of there when I did, because a lot of my coworkers were still there when the buildings came down. And of course, that was much more terrifying than it turned out being on the bridge. So that was my experience. And, it was only an hour of my life, but obviously extremely memorable. And a lot of it has stuck with me all these years later.
So Libby, I do have to ask you, because you're sort of a media maven. People follow you on Twitter as the hot mess, among other things. But what are you going to Twitter? What are you going to say on 9/11? Will you say anything?
Well, I actually have a piece that I wrote in 2015 about my experience, and I just reposted it, and I'll probably just share that again. I don't say too much, but I wrote up what happened and the insights I had, and I'll probably just share that again.
Well, we'll get to that a little more. I'd like to go next to Dorlisa Nazario. You lost an uncle on that day. So maybe tell us where you were and what was going on when the attack happened.
Yes, so I was in Memphis, Tennessee when this happened, but I'm originally from Lower East Side, Manhattan. And so I received a call from my aunt stating that she received a call from my uncle, who worked on the 97th floor in Tower 2. And he, at that time, left a message stating that he was worried, but he was okay. He believed that there was an earthquake. He thought it was an earthquake, and he would call when he returned home. And he never returned home. And we panicked, and we waited and waited. I mean, years waiting, because we never found any of his remains. So I was in Memphis, Tennessee, and I returned home a week later, and we continued to wait to find his remains, to hear back from him. We never heard back from him. And while I was there, because I live in Lower East Side Manhattan, and when I returned home, you could smell the debris, you could smell the bodies. I would get sick every night around 3 a.m. when it get dewy outside. You can smell this kick up, and not have an AC in our homes, just like here, we have our windows open. And so it was horrible. It was like being in another, just a war zone, because and even to go to the grocery store, you had to present your ID just to walk down the block. And there was tankers. There was tanks there with military requesting IDs just to leave your community. So it was really horrific. It was really disheartening. And at this point, I still don't know if there has been closure. But we know that, you know, he is no longer with us. And we visit the towers, and every year, Boyd Godden was his name, and he was born in Bermuda, and he returned to New York City to stay with my grandfather, and where he got his citizenship, permanent citizenship, and he was working at the World Trade Center. Every year in Bermuda, they hold a memorial because there was two people that went to his high school who were lost in the towers that day. We still have that voicemail. And we waited up until December. We were waiting for his remains, where the New York Post put an ad out, just a obituary where we had our memorial. It was very disheartening. But yeah, and I will say this, as New Yorkers, and as I told you the other day, when the towers came down, it forced people into our community that otherwise wouldn't come into our community. And we were there, and we did hold together strong. And I know we're going to go a bit into the divisions as of today, but I can say on that day, we were New York strong. We pulled together. We ran together. We fought together, and we got through it together. So I would like to say that. And I would just like to say, may Boyd Godden rest in peace.
Boy, that is quite a story. And even 20 years later, not to really have finality. That is really hard. Well, I'm going to go next to Christine.
It's just like yesterday.
It sounds like for each of you, the memories are so vivid. It's like you're talking about something that just happened. So I'd like to go next to Christina Apathy. Christina, I don't know anything about what your direct connection was, so I'm very interested to hear.
Yeah, I was hedging a bit about coming on today, but here I am. So Rhonda, for me, it wasn't so much about what I was doing, but what I wasn't doing. I had been temping for Marcy McLennan on the 97th floor of the World Trade Center 1 for a group of claims lawyers and their secretary. But I had made a doctor's appointment on that Tuesday and was in my 7th floor walk up on the West Village, about 2 miles from the financial district. At about 8:45 a.m., I heard what sounded like a lawnmower fly over my building, and then a boom, like you hear like a timpani in the symphony. And my roommate and I climbed up the fire escape to our roof, and I saw my office burning. The first thought I had was how silly for a pilot to fly his prop plane into a building when there's so much sky around. And then I said out loud, that's where I work. That's where I work. And I went down to call my parents. And when I came back up, the second plane had hit the World Trade Center 2.
So if you had been in that building and not at a doctor's appointment, all these students that learned the joy of theater through you and all the productions that you've been involved in, you wouldn't be a part of that if that had happened. That has got to be a weird feeling.
Indeed.
And how long did it take you to get over that sensation that it could have been me?
Well, Rhonda, I'm not sure that I am over it. It's an ongoing process.
Well, I thank you for being willing to come on to our program today, and I can understand your hesitation because of all that happened. And So I just have to ask you this, though, is how do you think that you might find some closure from this for you? I mean, it's been 20 years.
You know, talking about it helps. Yeah, that's all I'll say for now. I've written things down, but I'm also, I'm not so much flying off the cuff today.
Well, that's totally understandable, especially when you can't predict what emotions are going to well up. And maybe that's this is a good time to transition to Dr. Destiny Sargent, who was one of the psychologists that traveled to New York City with a group from Juneau to offer their help. And I guess there were law enforcement there. So tell us, Destiny, where you were on that day and then how you came to wind up in New York.
I remember being woken up by my radio alarm when I was laying flat to get ready for work and hearing about planes flying into buildings and thinking it was a science fiction. For a brief moment, I thought, this is not the normal radio station that I'm listening to. It didn't take me very long to realize that this was the real deal. And I knew instantly in my soul that our life had changed forever at such a profound level. And my training had been in both as a first responder paramedic and then as a trauma psychologist. I've been training for years in critical incident stress management and trauma. And it's just like I knew that this has changed our lives forever and that this was going to be a purpose for which I'd been an international trainer and I had been doing this for years. And this was like the culmination of everything in my life I believed that I had been trained for to be able to do this. And we had a team here in Juneau and I took three JPD and a firefighter and myself, and we went through the Critical Incident Stress Foundation and they rotated teams of us in. We specifically were targeting to assist at that time with the actual New York Police Department because about 16 acres was the area where this war zone literally was. And all the police there had to man this 24 hours a day and stare at the scene, which is very traumatic. And so we went to them because they couldn't get away. So I walked the pit, the pile, it was still burning, and we walked around and we went to the people. And mostly, again, our goal and purpose was to assist with the NYPD to keep them functional so that they could manage their lives while they were staring at trauma. And we took turns walking around the pit in the pile, and then we would go back to the federal bank. And that was sort of like, because it was close by, and that was our temporary office because there was no public allowed in that area at that time. And that was our office. And then we would be shipped out at the evening because there was no resources for us to stay there. So we would go down and spend all day for 12 hours working with the NYPD. And then they would take us back out on a bus and we stayed at a fire station close by. Well, you know, 20, 30 miles away. And then they would bus us back in the morning.
So you had to take in all those emotions swirling at you and all the sensory things that Dorlisa described, the smells, the awful smells, the ugliness of it all.
It's true. The best way I could describe it at the time and still is I saw the best and the worst of humanity. It was the best and worst of humanity. I don't know that it could be any different. And I was amazed at how the New Yorkers had come together. It was the culmination of my training. If there's ever a time in your life where you believe that this is where you're supposed to be, that's what that was for me. And I also believe that we made a difference. It helped me understand in my life that we made a difference. And we helped a lot of people out there working the pit during that time that I was there. And if you needed anything, the generosity of the American people and internationally, all the people, if you needed something, all you had to say is, I need a mask. And somebody put one literally in your hand. I had never experienced that any place in my life. And yet here I am in a virtual war zone and people had come together so powerfully that that's part of the best of the things that I ever got to see in my life.
And that part of it, we need to hold on to. Let's go around the group again, and we'll go back with Libby, and then next to Dorlisa, and then Christina, and then back to you, Destiny. But out of all of these experiences that you've had on the day of this tragedy, what followed, and right up until now, what rises to the top? So we'll start with you, Libby.
I mean, I think the thing that sticks out the most to me is just some of those images that are just like burned into my brain, you know, of the build and just the sensory experience of being inside of an attack like that, and watching the building fall and seeing, you know, working there, being off of work for 6 weeks, working there afterwards. The smells, all the things that Dorlisa mentioned too, being part of, you know, New York City, where I had been born and raised, in that moment, I think is the main thing I still think about. But I also, you know, I think about my parents' neighbor, the firefighter, Bill McGinn, who died, and he had two young children at the time. And I think about how they're in their 20s now, maybe even 30. And they probably barely remember him. So it's mostly that kind of visceral thinking that I do about the event, not so much the abstract things, but more just the immediate kind of experience.
Well,
of it.
You have quite the reputation as an activist. You know, you're not a person to stand silently by if you object to something. So did this tragedy change your life, perhaps send you on a different course, Libby?
I don't know if it would have changed the course of my life. You know, I was trying to just, at that time I was on the cusp of going to law school, and I decided to stay in New York and not leave New York. And maybe that was part of why I wanted to stay close to home after that. And I don't know that it specifically informed any of my activism per se, but it certainly has given me a lot of pause on things like, you know, security and war and the police state and things like that. And I think about, you know, specifically soldiers in war zones. It's given me a huge appreciation for post-traumatic stress disorder and other things that happen. I think about how short that period was. It was like an hour, like I said, an hour of my life, and people that are in war zones, either fighting as soldiers or as civilians, that are dealing with that every day. It's just amazing to me, because it took, I think, a full year for me to not like jump at every sound that I would hear. So it just gave me an overall appreciation for what it's like to live in a violent, in a really a situation like that, where that kind of thing is much more regular, I guess, you know, acts of war like that. So it gave me it caused me to do a lot of thinking about that.
Dorlisa, what rises to the top for you?
20 years later, when I think of 9/11, the first thing that just comes to my mind is it's like yesterday. It's like yesterday. And what rises to the top the most for me would be the fact that we're not passing and we're still in a very vulnerable state today. What rises to the top is the changes in which occurred because of September 11th and how it's affecting us today, and how we still haven't come to a complete conclusion of it, and how many people it affected. Just knowing that we're here in Juneau and we can pull different stories out of everywhere. And my mother popped in the room just to say, my friend was a firefighter who just passed away. And I have a friend in Anchorage who was touched by 9/11 and still is suffering. And it's still very current, even though it's two decades ago.
But now, you know, 20 years later, and I speak for myself, you know, I was a young woman, a young mother at the time. In fact, my son's birthday was around the corner, and it was very hard to get into the spirit of planning his birthday, and all of the parents that came to the birthday party with their kids, we were all kind of huddled talking and kind of collectively worried about our children's future, what kind of a world this was going to usher in. And, you know, do you have any thoughts on that, Dorlisa, about what this has done to our children, that generation that came up?
There is so much that occurred after. I had to touch base and just go back to just see like these laws that has passed since 9/11 and what they have done. And then I thought, did we have Facebook at that time? And now we have Facebook and we have all these social media things, and we have to go through the TSA to get on the plane, and we can't have over 3 ounces of liquid. So these children, they don't know what the world was like before. They know the world now, today, and they don't know why that change occurred, but we were there. It was current for us, and we know why. So yeah, I think about the kids and how this may have affected them. I think, and I don't know if it's a good or bad thing. I don't know if it's better or worse, because as a people, we've become so numb to many things that I would have thought after 9/11 would have stuck with us. That the pulling together and the helping one another and those things, I wish we could have grown from there. And it seems like we're still struggling to stay, remain, and get there.
Christina, what rises to the top for you?
I think what Dorlisa was saying, you know, the collection of stories of people. I just watched this extremely good documentary called Memory Box, Echoes of 9/11. Which was told through recollections and eyewitness testimony. And, you know, people would go inside this small plywood box and just talk. And they talked right afterwards, and then they talked again this year, 20 years later. And it was so profound and simple and healing and democratic. And I just highly recommend it, because it was just a real snapshot of, you know, lots of folks' unique stories that, you know, are ordinary, that were ordinary on that day, but are extraordinary at the same time.
Well, you work with a lot of young people. And of course, the young people don't know the world that we lived in pre-9/11, you know, all the kinds of things that we enjoyed. Do you think about sort of the low-level inflammation that has existed since 9/11 and how it's affecting our upcoming generations?
You know, I do work with kids, but, you know, my work with kids brings joy into my life. And my work on 9/11 has been very personal work for me. So when I think about, you know, the inflammation, quote unquote, that we live with, you know, I've had my own health issues, chronic issues that I think stem from living just outside the zone for 5 years after that happened, you know, and the dust. And I'm proud of all our perseverance, for lack of a better Juno word, you know, and just in terms of, like, you know, just re-engaging every day. And yeah, society is, you know, we're here together, the kids in school bring joy into my life. Theater friends, larger than life Juno friends, keep me present and joyful. And also, you know, there's this other thing that's there. Talking about 9/11 is, I came up with a metaphor today. It's like sneaking up on a bear. Like, I don't know if the bear is going to get triggered and like charge at me or just like turn towards me and sniff the air and put his nose back into a trash can. And I'm always me, but I'm also like also dancing with that bear every day.
Boy, that is a very powerful way to put it. I mean, dancing with a bear that you don't know is going to lash out at you or leave you alone. Wow. Well, we're running out of time here, so I guess this is probably going to be the last comment that we have. So, Destiny, we'll let you wrap things up for us here. Wish we could talk more because there is, I'm sure, so much more to share and discuss.
There's so much more, but again, I do believe it changed us substantially as people. It brought us together. We got to see horror and generosity all at the same time. I know for me that it defined me wanting to do even better. I spent the rest of my professional life working with people with trauma and really focusing on that in a whole new way. There was nothing that is scary to go to, you know, when people are ready. And sometimes you just need to talk about it and walk with people. I know that it took me a very long time myself to be the receptacle of everybody else's pain when I got back. It probably took me a year before I could even really grieve my own sense of, you know, what had gone on. I left my children to go, and my son remembers it, but my daughter was too little. And so I just think that I consider it such a tremendous privilege that I could never forget. And I have a thing of my keepsakes from New York, and it probably really identified the rest of my professional career and everything I believe in for helping and bringing people unity and together and helping people not hold trauma in their bodies.
And what was the thing that you kept from that? You alluded to it just now. Do you care to share?
Well, there's always hope. I believe that people are incredibly strong survivors and very resilient. And sometimes we deserve extra support, but absolutely, without a doubt, we can go through terribly hard things and come out. And there is always hope. I believe there is always hope, no matter how hard things are, and that we don't have to walk alone through it, and that there are people that can help. And I believe it myself, and we all help in different ways. And it's okay to not be okay. And it's also okay just to share the pain with people. It's okay to share our stories so that young people know what it's like. They won't know. They won't be able to relate. Just like people, young people don't know about Vietnam, yet my father was there and I grew up in the military. You know, young, really young people don't remember 9/11, but it's through our sharing that it helps fill in the overall struggle of what people have been through together and why it may contribute to our unity or our division. And I think it's really important that we learn the lessons. And I hope that I will always keep an open mind to continue to learn the lessons.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much, all four of you, for taking time out to be with us. Libby Bacalar, Dorlisa Nazario, Christina Apathy, and Dr. Destiny Sargent. Thank you so much. And we hope that tomorrow will be a very life-affirming day for all of you. Thank you. Next, what prompted the Juneau Glacier Valley Rotary Club to build one of the first permanent memorials for 9/11 in the nation? How it is still a work in progress, just like our recovery from 9/11.
Support for Juneau Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juneau with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juneau. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride here, sifting through some of the memories of the September 11th terrorist attacks. Royal Hill Sr. of Hoonah was out commercial fishing on 9/11. When the United States went to war over the attack, as a Vietnam veteran, he worried that history would repeat itself and says his fears were realized with America's recent sudden exit from Afghanistan.
This is twice we've done it now. The third strike, you're out.
Hill says 20 years later, we haven't solved anything and only become more divided as a nation socially and politically.
America has always stood up for the downtrodden, but in this country, it's getting so bad now that we got both parties fighting amongst themselves instead of really getting together and trying to solve problems. All they're doing is fighting amongst themselves.
Hill says his wish on this 9/11 is that somehow we can find a way to let go of hate.
As a Native person, I feel it's very wrong. Hatred is one of the ugliest of the emotions, causes a lot of heartache and misery. Like Martin Luther King said, don't judge me until you know the content of my heart.
Hill was drafted out of high school in Hoonah. He served in the 25th Infantry Division in Vietnam. In the aftermath of 9/11, the country came together in a spirit of rare unity, one that the Juneau Glacier Valley Rotary hoped to keep alive in a memorial that it built in 2002, just 1 year after the attacks. And joining me now from Glacier Valley Rotary, Brent Fisher, who designed the memorial, his wife Debbie Penrose Fisher, who he says was the inspiration for this project. And we also have Michelle Strickler, current president of the Rotary. Well, thank you all for being here with us today to remind us about the reasons for this memorial. But Brent, I want to start off with you to just tell us what sparked this project.
Well, my wife. So I think if you want to get on the very, very beginning, my wife is the start, the inspiration. So if we can let her talk about it first, then she'll get it to a place where then I jumped in and started. So
okay, Debbie, cue it up for us.
Okay. Well, quickly, if I can just preface that there are markers or in events in all of our lives, and these events capture a moment in time forever. Births, weddings, the loss of a loved one. For me, 9/11 is that. I remember exactly where I was, what I saw on the TV, the shock as it unfolded, images of planes into buildings and towers imploding and people in the streets of New York running covered in ash. That day is indelibly marked in my brain. And after that initial shock of the horror of that day, something amazing began. I remember watching Congress standing on the steps of the Capitol, each one of them with little flags, singing God Bless America. Patriotism was truly, to me, reborn. Flags, I don't know if you remember, flags being flown everywhere off of trucks and businesses and houses, and cities across the nation designated places where candles, cards, and flowers could be placed. And that momentum swelled up in me, and I bugged my husband every day, where can Juno do that? Where can we process our grief? Where can we express our patriotism? And I really did nag him every day. And one day, driving down Riverside Drive, past the park we love, I said, what about Rotary? What about a flag memorial? And he said, that's an idea. And he went home and went in a separate room, came back later with a meaningful sketch of the memorial we now have. So the simple idea with inspired design met with green lights all along the way. Rotary embraced it, the city embraced it, and as a result, we have a memorial in a year, the first in the nation. So there you go.
So, Brent, what inspired the design besides Debbie making you put this project on her quote-unquote, what my husband would call a honey-do list?
Yeah, well, now you can see why and how that memorial came to be. It was certainly Debbie behind it. So I was a Rotarian at the time, and what kind of inspired is I had a childhood friend of mine that I was in scouts with, and he was on the Flight 77 that hit the Pentagon. And so when Debbie talked about a flagpole, it was, I started just with some sketches of, you know, what could we put? It was kind of just your standard foundation for a flagpole, and just kind of maybe divine intervention or, you know, inspiration or something. Pentagon came to me. And so that's what started it. So with the symbolization or the symbolism within the memorial itself, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but that's what kind of inspired it. And just the things just kind of fell together and of the design but that's what inspired it.
But you also have a direct connection to this story, I understand. Can you tell us about that?
Well, like I said, I had a childhood friend in scouts, Christopher Newton, who was on the way back from back to California to pick up his dog. It had moved back east, and so he was on the flight that hit the Pentagon. So that was my personal connection, just like I said, a childhood friend.
You know, it is kind of amazing today that we have people with direct connections to something that was so far away from us. And probably people wonder, like, why Juneau, which is, you know, a continent away from where these terrorist attacks were on the other side. Why us to be one of the first to have a memorial?
Debbie and I talked about this morning, and I'm going to let her say it because she's much better at words and articulating things. I can draw things, but she is definitely one who can communicate well. But we talked about it, and I truly believe what she said is how we feel about why Juneau.
Well, we were saying that distance doesn't limit your heart reaction, and that we're all Americans first. And this was I don't think that the distance made any difference in how it impacted people. So, fortunately, CBJ and Rotary moved this forward. Everyone seemed to want it. It kind of resounded. And it's really something I'm so proud of that is a testament to a community working together. So yes, it's a wonderful way to honor the people whose lives were lost, but it also in a separate way speaks to the community of Juneau and how, when we work together, amazing things get done. And I'm really proud of that accomplishment.
Well, I want to go to Michelle before we run out of time. So this memorial, everybody's been working on it, sprucing it up. There's a new wall that's added, new bricks that have been placed in there with new dedications. So Michelle, what do we need to know about tomorrow if we want to be a part of the ceremony?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Rhonda. We're so excited to get to host this commemorative event, and as has been shared, this is a significant thing for Glacier Valley Rotary, now this being our 20th anniversary of hosting this event and getting the opportunity to celebrate and honor our first responders and the members of the armed forces community that come. It is truly a touching and somber event, and it's a way to remember the past, our pledge to remember, and also to honor those we stand by today. So please come ready for the weather. We have done some work at the memorial. It's very beautiful, but there's some areas due to the rain that are a little sloppy. So please wear rubber boots and be prepared for that. We do ask the public to gather beginning around 9:40 a.m. because we do start pretty promptly between 9:45 and 9:50 because there's a very special color guard where the flag is brought to half-mast precisely at the time that the first tower, representing the time the first tower fell. So there's a strict timeline The entire event is only about 20, 30 minutes. So we're done at 10:15. Now, tomorrow is going to be significant because it is the 20th commemoration. We've had a replica pin made that everyone in attendance, until they run out, will receive a really beautiful pin that is a replica of the memorial. So right down to the forget-me-not flowers that symbolize our commitment to never forget. So we do so look forward to seeing Juno's community out there, and we are just honored and privileged to work together as a community and continue this celebration.
All right. Well, we want to thank you very much, the three of you, for being here, sharing your thoughts about what's behind this memorial, and also giving us an avenue to think about what happened 20 years ago. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Are listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Thanks for being here with us on this Friday. In our community, no matter what happens, the healing power of nature is always close at hand. And on September 11th, 2001, when the skies suddenly went quiet, one of those Alaskans who had a chance to get reacquainted with silence was Brenda Wright with the Juno Audubon Society, who joins us every Friday to spotlight a few of the birds to watch for. But Brenda, I'd like to start off by asking you about 9/11, because like a lot of people, you probably remember exactly what you were doing when you heard about the attacks.
Yes, it's something, a memory that I just will never forget, I'm sure. I just turned the radio on driving to work and heard it. And I was so startled and scared. I had to pull over and stop and listen for a few minutes and try to understand.
Well, as a person who's out in nature a lot, you know, you're really sensitive to the sounds of Juno. What was that like to have that kind of quiet?
It was just startlingly silent. The birds are not real loud in September, but boy, you could hear every little peep and twitch in the grasses through all three of those silent airspace days.
So in looking back on that, how do you feel about that?
You know, it's a very strange feeling. Where we live, we desperately need air travel. Everyone knows that. And it was the most scary thing to me was thinking, if someone in the village got really sick and needed to go to the hospital, would they let them? It just made me fret with worry about how important air travel is to us here in Southeast.
I suppose on this 9/11 anniversary, the 20th anniversary, that things like the freedom to go out and watch birds and do all the things that we do should mean all the more to us.
Yes, everything that we have as Americans is very precious, and it's a sad, sad memory to remind us, but it's a good thing to be reminded of how much our freedoms are worth.
So one of the freedoms that people in Juneau enjoy is the opportunity to go out and see beautiful birds, so many of them. We have quite a few migrating. What are you noticing these days when you're out and about?
Well, it is still really fun. Duck hunting season did start on September 1st. So places that are much better to find migrants now are areas where hunting is not usually allowed, like Eagle Beach or at Salmon Creek. The ducks get pretty smart really fast.
So let's talk about one of the ducks that you're highlighting this week, the long-tailed duck.
Yes, this is a really interesting bird. It totally changes its costume from summer to winter. Summer, it's mostly dark with some white highlights, but winter, it's white with black highlights. The male has quite a nice long tail. It's easy to see why they are called long-tailed ducks, and they stay around Juneau. The food they like is actually out of the open channels, but they'll come in closer when there's a nice little herring run or some other small fish in our harbors.
We're going to play a little bit of sound from this bird, and just a warning, birds this week are not necessarily good singers.
Not melodious.
Our next bird is the northern saw-whet owl. What can you tell us about this bird?
Well, you know, this is a very small owl, and we're really lucky to have it because it likes to give its distinctive call about 3 to 4 o'clock in the morning. And I've always called it the backup bird. If you listen to the sound, I'm sure you'll understand why.
And our last bird is the downy woodpecker.
Yes, this is our smallest woodpecker here in town. And it actually looks very, very much like the hairy woodpecker.
Does downy have a softer call?
Not necessarily, no. And they still hit their head on the wood to get all those wonderful grubs and insects that they eat.
So where will we find you this weekend?
I'll be at Eagle Beach for sure if I'm not picking berries.
Boy, Eagle Beach seems to be your favorite haunt.
It's a wonderful place, especially during hunting season. There's no hunting allowed there, and the birds are not nervous.
Ah, we don't want nervous birds. All right, well, thank you very much. Brenda Wright with the Juneau Audubon Society highlighting 3 birds for us to be on the lookout for. Have a good weekend, Brenda.
Thank you, Rhonda. You too.
And thank you for joining us. Hope all of you have a restful weekend.